I feel like there's always a steady tug on my life to pull me more towards being dangerous for the domain of darkness, or at least to not make me dangerous for the kingdom of light. There's always that just tug, probably coming from the domain of darkness, the world, Satan, the flesh. And if something doesn't happen to draw me back, I'd be in trouble. There is always, though, when I feel tugged, there's forces working to bring me back. And maybe some of you can relate to that. And I want to start by talking about two forces that God continually uses to keep pulling me back on course, to be dangerous for the kingdom of light. One is God's people. He uses his people that surround me, friends, church, family, to pull me back. The other force that he uses is his love letter to me, the written word of God. God uses that to pull me back on course. Let me start by talking about just how God uses people sometime. I trusted Christ as a freshman football player at Michigan State. And early on, I started attending a Christian group on campus. And my buddy Randy and I would always stand in the back of this meeting. And we'd have our letter jackets on and stand in the back with our arms folded. And we liked to be there because we liked the speaker. The speaker would say things that we found relevant and helpful and from the Bible. And so we liked to hear it. I was a baby, young believer. We didn't really like the singing too much. They did a lot of really things that we felt like were beneath us and dorky and goofy. And so we would just keep standing like that, and they'd be doing all kinds of things with their hands, and we just didn't get into that. When the night would end, Randy and I would always just make our way to the door. That's why we were in the back, so we could get out of there as soon as possible. And one day, we were in the back, the meeting ended, and we headed toward the door. And I heard this little voice speak up and say, "Todd, Randy." And I looked, and it was this little girl named Susie Fritzlin. And she came over, kind of skipping over to us, and she came up to about there on us. And she said, "Hey, can I ask you guys a question?" And Randy and I looked at each other and said, "Yeah, go ahead." And she said, "Listen, I've noticed that every week you come to this meeting, and then you're always the first to leave. Why is that?" And I said, and I hemmed and I hawed, and then I said, "You know, we're very busy with football. I'm a pretty serious student. There's a lot of stuff I need to get to tonight, so we just have to get going." And then she said, "Well, could I say something else?" And I said, "Yeah, go ahead." And she said, "Well, I think you guys are really neat, and I think there's a lot of people here who would really like to get to know you guys better, so..." And then she said, "One more thing, there's a lot of really great people here who I think you would really benefit from getting to know more." The first part of that statement made me feel, I think she's flattering us. She said we're neat and they would benefit from getting to know us. The second part she shared about we need them, I didn't really like it. I thought to myself, I think she's telling me that we need these people. And I didn't really like how that felt. I was smiling, and I said, "Well, okay, well, thanks, Susie. We're going to go now." And we left, and I had a smile on my face. But on the inside, I was thinking, who is this little pipsqueak girl, Susie, to come up and get in our face and tell us that we need to stick around because we need these people? I didn't like it. The next few years, I had similar experiences with people, where people would say stuff to me that was kind of like that. This is what it would sound like. They'd say things like, "Todd, I really wanted to get to know you, and I was looking forward to us having a friendship, but it always has seemed like that's been hard. I don't feel like we ever got as close as I thought we would." And I heard that a few different times the next few years, and every time when someone would say it, I'd be smiling on the outside, but on the inside, I'd be thinking, what is this person's problem? Why are they in my face? Our friendship is fine. And then as I started to contemplate it, I started to think, this is happening over and over again. There's a pattern. And that brings me to the second way God has always tried to, I think, bring me back when I'm drifting. And that came from the Bible. I think I was a newlywed in the first year or two of marriage. I loved the Word of God. I was studying 1 Samuel. I worked my way through 1 Samuel, and I learned all about David, this man after God's own heart. And I was learning about his life. I was learning about leadership, what it really looked like to trust God. I also saw another guy named Jonathan in there, and I learned all kinds of things about trusting God there. And I got to the end of 1 Samuel, and then I said, man, that was so good. I have to move on to 2 Samuel. So I moved on to 2 Samuel, and eager to get a start there. And I want to read for you a verse that I came across as I started 2 Samuel. So at the beginning of 2 Samuel, the first king of Israel, Saul, and his son Jonathan had been killed in battle at the hand of the Philistines who were oppressing them. So Saul, his son Jonathan, had been killed. David was still alive, and he was mourning for the first king and for the king's son Jonathan, who had become his friend. And as he was mourning, we know that Jonathan was a poet warrior. This is what he wrote. He said, this is chapter 1, verse 26, speaking of Jonathan. He said, "I am distressed for you, my brother Jonathan. You have been very pleasant to me. Your love to me was more wonderful than the love of women." And when I read that, it just struck me as, this is different. What is going on here? Jonathan was dead. David's mourning for him, and he makes the statement where he says, "You've been very pleasant to me, Jonathan. Your love for me was more wonderful than the love of women." And I knew that David had a background with a lot of women. And yet he was saying his relationship with Jonathan was something even better than that. And so I was puzzled by that, and I started to realize, okay, Jonathan and David, those two men, had some sort of a relationship that was very unique. And here's the thing that struck me about that, that was like God starting to get my attention here. I realized I had spent months studying 1 Samuel, and I never considered the friendship of Jonathan and David. It never crossed my mind to even think about those two guys and their friendship. Why do you think that was? Why do you think that was that I never even noticed their friendship? Well, that was very revealing about myself. See, I had come to Christ as a very, very independent and strong college football player, who I really felt like I didn't need anyone else. I lived life where I just said, you show me what to do, I'm going to roll up my sleeves and I'm going to attack that thing, and I'll do it better than anyone else. And when I, and that, you know, that had served me very well through school, through football. And so when I became a Christian, I brought those tendencies with me into my new relationship with God. And my attitude was pretty much, give me God, give me His Word, give me some spiritual disciplines, give me some things I need to go do for Him, and I'm going to roll up my sleeves and do them better than anyone else. I was fiercely independent. I did not value relationships with other people like that. And so that's why I was totally blind to it. It was almost like God reached out through that verse, picked me off the ground so my little feet were dangling, and looked me in the eyes and said, okay, Langerveld, you've known there's been a problem here. You kept saying the problem was with everyone else. Maybe the problem's not with them, it's with you. And he was right. He always is. And I realized there was a problem. And so I said, I've got to go back and study 1 Samuel again. And this time, I need to focus on Jonathan and David and their friendship so that I could learn from God what that should be, what his will for my life as far as relationships go. I was eager to learn, and so I started to study. I went back, started to study, looking for traits or marks of what I call dangerous friendship. The kind of friendship with other people that makes us more dangerous for the kingdom of light against the domain of darkness. Started to realize I've been trying to do that on my own, but I needed others. So as I went back and started going through 1 Samuel again, what all I want to do today in the next little bit of time is just highlight, I think I came up with 7 or 8 characteristics from their friendship that I would say were marks or traits of dangerous friendship. I want to highlight a few of those. We don't have time to go through all of them. And highlight some of those, highlight how they fell on me and affected me, and then share how they might maybe affect you, things that you might consider too as you consider your own relationships. First thing I noticed about Jonathan and David, there was a fertile, like, soil that became this fertile ground for the seeds of their dangerous friendship to take root and begin to grow. This fertile soil really consisted of trials, difficulties, hard things. That was one of the things. The second thing that included was they shared a common spiritual background. The two men shared a common spiritual background. That served as this rich, fertile soil. The trials, the common spiritual background for their dangerous friendship to begin to take hold. We know that the main trial at that time that Israel was facing was oppression by the Philistines. And Israel was in a bad spot. They weren't armed. The Philistines were completely oppressing them. And in chapter 14 of 1 Samuel, what we see is the Philistines were dominating Israel. Israel wasn't armed. The men of Israel were hiding in rocks from the Philistines who were dominating them. The Philistines were people who were uncircumcised. They did not know God. They weren't the covenant people of God. They were far from God. And yet, they were dominating the people of God at that time, physically. They were intimidating them. In that scene, Jonathan, the son of Saul, the first king, was with his armor bearer, his dangerous friend. And he surveyed that scene of the Philistines dominating and oppressing the people of God. And as Jonathan looked at that scene, there was a rocky crag, and then over here another rocky crag, and you had the Philistines over here, you had Israel over here, this garrison of Philistines was intimidating. Jonathan looked at that. He surveyed the scene, and he said, wait a minute. I know who my God is. I know we are his people. These are the people of God. I know these people don't know God. They're oppressing us. This is not the way things should be. And that completely unsettled Jonathan. Jonathan turned to his armor bearer and said, let's do something. Let's show ourselves to these Philistines, and maybe God will deliver us, deliver them into our hand. And the armor bearer, as an incredible, dangerous friend, said to Jonathan, he said, whatever you want to do, you do it, and I'll be right there at your right hand. I'll be behind you. You go. I'm with you. This is what you see and found in your heart that we should do to trust God, and let's do it. What's amazing is just a few verses later, you see first of all, you've got Jonathan and the armor bearer show themselves, and the Philistines see them, and they say, they started to taunt Jonathan and David, kind of an ancient version of what would be athletes call trash talking. The Philistines were trash talking, mocking Jonathan and David, and they said, come on over here to this side and we'll teach you a lesson. And Jonathan and his armor bearer had known that if that was the response, then they were going to take that as a sign from God that he was about to deliver those Philistines into their hand. So they climbed to the other side, and the next thing you know, a few verses later, there's 20 Philistines who are dead at the hand of Jonathan and David, God's power through Jonathan and David, and 20 are dead. The rest of the army of Israel saw that and was stirred to great faith. They were rallied, and they began to pursue the Philistines, and the whole tide was turned. That's in 1 Samuel 14. You read three chapters later of David, a young warrior like Jonathan. He is first a shepherd, though. He's sent as a young man by his father, Jesse, to the front lines to check on the welfare of his older brothers and the battle, what's going on there. David comes up onto that scene. It's very similar to the scene from 1 Samuel 14. You've got, again, Philistines dominating and intimidating the army of Israel. The Philistines send forward their champion, Goliath, who's taunting the armies of the living God, mocking, saying, send out your champion against our champion, the winner takes all. David came to that scene not to fight, but to bring provisions and check on things. He surveyed the scene and he said, wait a minute, I know who my God is. I know who these people are. We're the people of God. I know these people don't know God, and yet they're mocking us. This is not the way things should be. There was no champion found by the Israelites to send over to go against Goliath. David looks at that scene and he said, this is not the way things should be. The next thing we know, David is running to those front lines, armed with a sling, some stones, and the next thing we know, the giant hits the ground. And then David's standing over him with a big sword in one hand and a head in the other hand. And the rest of the army sees that happen. They're rallied to faith and action. And they begin now to dominate. Those two videos are so similar. I think they reveal to us that Jonathan and David shared a common spiritual background. Both of those young men had a track record of walking with God. They didn't just know about God, they knew God. Second thing that was true of their background is they were both passionate. But unlike most men, they weren't passionate for their own glory. They were passionate for God's glory. Third thing is they both had this tendency then, because of their passion for God and His glory, to take bold action or bold steps when no one else would in order to honor God and serve God's people. So we saw them doing very, very similar things. That was the fertile ground. The afflictions, the trials, and that common spiritual background, the common ground for those two men to become dangerous friends. We need to check our own lives and just make sure that fertile soil is present. We don't have to go looking for trials and hard times usually. Those are going to come on earth. And then the second issue is, what is my spiritual background like? How about the people around me? What is their spiritual background like? And if that's in place, then the stage is set. There's potential for dangerous friendship. The next thing I observed about Jonathan and David was how that dangerous friendship was initiated. David had had this great victory. Jonathan before him had had a great victory. There had been a great celebration for Jonathan, and he was honored. Now David had done something great. Saul looked at David and said, what this young warrior has done is amazing. And he sent for David, had him brought to his own home so that he could honor him, even like he was his own son. Now, I want you to put yourself in the skin of Jonathan. You're the son, biologically, of Saul, the first king. You're the natural heir to the throne of your father. You have accomplished great things. You've been celebrated. Your father's honored you. Other people have honored you. And now there's this new other young buck being brought into your household by your dad. He's fawning over him, almost like he's his own son. How would you feel if you were Jonathan and this other young warrior was brought into your household and all this was going on? Do you realize the stage was set for there to be a power play? Something brutal was about to happen. You just know these two young warriors were going to shed blood to solve this power play. And we see what happens in 1 Samuel chapter 18, 1 through 4. 1 Samuel 18, 1 through 4. 1 Samuel 18, 1 through 4. Let me read that. Now it came about when he had finished speaking to Saul that the soul of Jonathan was knit to the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him as himself. And Saul took him that day and did not let him return to his father's house. Then Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as himself. And Jonathan stripped himself of the robe that was on him and gave it to David with his armor, including his sword and his bow and his belt. We would expect a bloodbath, and the bloodbath never happens. It's because of the way Jonathan responded to David. We might expect there to be pride, resentment, jealousy, hatred, hostility. That's not how Jonathan responded. He responded with humility and love. And he made a covenant with David. He looked at David, and it's almost like he looked at him, and in his mind and heart, he said, I'm not going to fight with this one. And he took really emblems almost of his identity, if you think about it, that he would take his robe, his armor, his weapons as a young warrior, heir to the throne, and he laid them down at David's feet. It's like he was saying, okay, David, I see you. I'm not going to fight against you. There will be no struggle here for power. Your heart beats like my heart. My heart beats like your heart. You know God. I know God. Not just about him. We know him. We know what he's like. We're both passionate, not for our glory, but for his glory. I want to lock arms with you, and I want us to take steps to honor God and serve his people. If there was potential for a struggle, a bloodbath, it was completely dissipated at that point because of humility, love, and a covenant commitment, Jonathan to David, and vice versa. We live in a world where men are like young bucks. And when other strong young bucks come into an area, there's going to be a tendency of putting your head down and wanting to ram heads. And a lot of times, friendships of men in our society, they go only so far as sharing things like a common hobby, or maybe making money together, or drinking alcohol together, or just having some common interests. There's nothing necessarily bad about those kinds of friendships, but those aren't dangerous friendships like we're talking about today. There's got to be something else that happens so that men don't just contend, especially with other strong men. Jealousy, envy, hatred, hostility did not take over this relationship, but instead These two men's souls were knit together because they responded in humility and love. Do you have anyone like that in your life? I remember as a young staff guy, I went to what was called the Ohio State Training Center, my first year on staff with Campus Crusade for Christ. And that was the training center was a place where potential young leaders would go to get 2 years of training in one, so then we could be sent out all over the country to direct campuses. And I was pretty young. I went there. I got trained. Karen and I both worked at Ohio State together at the training center. We got trained there together. And when that year was done, she went out to Sacramento State to become right-hand person to Tim and Renee, who were there. And Tim was acting as the director at Sac State. He was a young leader, a year ahead of me and Karen. And when I was in Minnesota, Karen and I ended up going from friends to engaged and got married 10 months later. And we made a decision that rather than Karen joining me in Minnesota, I was going to join her on her staff team with Tim and Renee at Sacramento State in California. So I showed up at the campus that fall, and Tim hadn't really chosen me. He inherited me through Karen, and he was a young leader. He had seen some really cool things happen early in his leadership. They had seen neat things happen at Sacramento State in the ministry. Now he gets word that this other young buck is showing up from the Ohio State Training Center, trained and equipped to become a campus director. Do you see what the stage was set for as I showed up at Sac State? A potential bloodbath, maybe. And I remember the first day I got to campus and to meet with Tim. The first really good thing Tim did was he said, "Let's meet at Burger King." And you could get a Whopper for 89 cents. So that was a really good move on Tim's part. We sat down, we started eating Whoppers together. That was a good beginning. And then the first two things came out of Tim's mouth, I still remember. The first thing Tim said was, he said, "Todd, I have the title of campus director here, but I want you to know I'm not going to see myself as the director and you like my senior man. I see us as being directors together. I want to lead together with you." The second thing he said was, he said, "I've heard that you really know how to share your faith with lost people well. And I don't feel like I do that as well, so I wondered if I could go with you and watch you in action and learn from you." How do you think those two comments landed on me when Tim said those things? It was almost like if Tim would have had a big cape, a crown, a scepter, or a sword or whatever, and all these things said campus director, it was like he took all that stuff off, and he laid it at my feet, and he said, "Hey, Todd, I think our hearts are beating together. I'm not going to fight you. Let's lock arms together and go after this campus together for Christ." And here we are, 33 years later, incredibly intimate friendship between us. But that's how it began, because Tim Rule made a decision to respond to this other young buck leader, not with pride, not with jealousy or envy. He wasn't threatened. Instead, he embraced me with humility and love. And I will say that day our souls immediately began to be knit together. Well, things started really good for David in Saul's household. But we also know, if you know much about Saul, you'll know he was a very, very insecure leader. He had been a man chosen because of what was going on the outside, not what was going on the inside. And leaders like that do a lot of damage and are very, very insecure and usually threatened by other strong leaders. And that happened to Saul. As he looked at this young man, David, initially he was excited, he was honoring him. Very quickly he became intimidated, threatened, jealous, pretty soon after that, he determined he needed David dead. So he started to scheme to have David killed. He even tried to bring his son Jonathan into it to have David killed. And what's amazing is not only did Jonathan go along with his father, but Jonathan went around behind David's back, and to his father, he defended David against those unrealistic thoughts about David. Saul believed all kinds of things that weren't true about David. David was loyal to Saul. He was a loyal warrior, and yet Saul did not believe that. So Jonathan went behind David's back, protected him, sheltered him with positive gossip, and it was enough, at least for a short time, to turn Saul's mind back to thinking, oh, I guess I'm okay with David. That lasted a short time, but then he flipped back, and again, he saw David as a threat. Again, he determined he was going to have him killed. So David went to Jonathan. David was like at his end. He knew he was loyal to Saul, but he knew Saul was determined to kill him. So he went to Jonathan to tell him that, basically to request help from his buddy, the only man he truly could trust. And he went to Jonathan, told him what his father was up to. Jonathan's initial response was, "That can't be. If that was true, I would know it. My dad would have told me that." David presses and basically lets him know that is true. Jonathan believes David. And at that point, Jonathan says something to David that is amazing. He responds in an amazing way. And we read about it in 1 Samuel chapter 20, verses 1 through 4. 1 Samuel 20, 1 through 4. Listen especially for verse 4, what Jonathan says to David. Starting at verse 1 of chapter 20. Then David fled from Naoth in Ramah and came and said to Jonathan, "What have I done? What is my iniquity? What's my sin before your father that he's seeking my life?" And he said to him, "Far from it. You shall not die. Behold, my father does nothing, either great or small, without disclosing it to me. So why should my father hide this thing from me? It is not so." Yet David vowed again, saying, "Your father knows well that I have found favor in your sight. He has said, 'Do not let Jonathan know this, lest he be grieved.' But truly, as the Lord lives and as your soul lives, there is hardly a step between me and death." Then listen how Jonathan responds. Then Jonathan said to David, "Whatever you say, I will do for you. Whatever you say, I will do for you." David is at his end. His buddy Jonathan looks him in the eye and says, "I believe you. Whatever you say, I will do for you." He offers himself to his friend completely, exhaustively available to his buddy. He made no qualifications. He didn't say, "I'll help you a little here, a little there, if it's convenient or if it might work out for me." He basically said, "You say the word, David. Whatever you say, I will do that for you." What must that have felt like to David in that moment to feel like, who can I trust? I'm a step ahead of death, to have his buddy look him in the eye and offer to help him. I think there are two amazing things that happened here that would not have happened if pride would have dominated this interaction between these two men. First of all, if David had been prideful and had the attitude like I had as a young believer, where I was fiercely independent, David would have never made his need known to Jonathan. He would have kept it to himself, and he never would have looked to Jonathan for help. That's one of the ways pride shows itself. There's a hesitancy for us to look outside of ourselves for help. The second thing I notice is that pride didn't take Jonathan over in this moment. If Jonathan would have been filled with pride, he would not have offered himself like this to David, because he would have been too busy thinking about himself, his own needs. He would have been selfish. He would have been holding on to his own life, saying, "No, I'm not going to help this man in this situation." But he didn't do that. Instead, he offers himself completely. Again, both men show humility here. It shows itself in different ways. One man admitting need and asking for help. The other man offering whatever help is needed. So this is a little survey of you. You don't have to show your hands. You can just register it internally. Where does pride show up most often in your life personally? Does it show up in a tendency for you to kind of be closed off and unavailable to help other people and their needs? You don't really tune into their needs. You have always something that keeps you from helping someone else, or it's always really, really restricted the amount you're willing to help. Or does pride show up in your life on the other side where you say, oh, I'll help anybody at any time. I'll drop everything to go help someone. But you're very slow to admit your own need, and you're very hesitant to ask for help from someone else. Probably we fall out on either extreme and maybe somewhere in the middle. Pride did not keep this encounter from happening here. Humility ruled that moment, and as a result, something incredible was about to happen to these two guys. What was amazing is not only did Jonathan offer himself completely to his buddy, but then he kept his promise to his buddy. He followed through and did exactly what David needed him to do, even though it cost him everything. They came up with a plan. The two men came up with a plan where there was a Jewish religious festival at that time. And there was going to be banquets at the king's table several days in a row. So David told Jonathan, you go to that banquet, your father's household, your father's banquet table, and I'm not going to go. So my chair's going to be empty. And I want you to watch and see how your dad responds to my empty chair. And then you come back and let me know. And we'll know that if your father is upset, that he does indeed intend to kill me. So Jonathan says, I'll do it. And he goes and he carries out the plan while David is waiting in safety. And we read about what happens as Jonathan faithfully carries out the plan, starting in chapter 20, verse 24. And I'm going to read through verse 34. Verse 24 through 34. And as I read this, I want you to listen. There were three things that Jonathan was willing to sacrifice for his friendship with David. Three things he was willing to sacrifice. See if you can pick them out as we read through. Verse 24. So David hid in the field. And when the new moon came, the king sat down to eat food. And the king sat on his seat as usual, the seat by the wall. Then Jonathan rose up, and Abner sat down by Saul's side. But David's place was empty. Nevertheless, Saul did not speak anything that day, for he thought, it is an accident. He is not clean. Surely he is not clean. And it came about the next day, the second day of the new moon, that David's place was empty. So Saul said to Jonathan, his son, why has the son of Jesse not come to the meal either yesterday or today? Jonathan then answered Saul, David earnestly asked leave of me to go to Bethlehem. For he said, please let me go, since our family has a sacrifice in the city, and my brother has commanded me to attend. And now, if I have found favor in your sight, please let me get away, that I may see my brothers. For this reason he has not come to the king's table. Then Saul's anger burned against Jonathan, and he said to him, you son of a perverse, rebellious woman. Do I not know that you are choosing the son of Jesse to your own shame and to the shame of your mother's nakedness? For as long as the son of Jesse lives on the earth, neither you nor your kingdom will be established. Therefore now send and bring him to me, for he must surely die. But Jonathan answered Saul his father and said to him, why should he be put to death? What has he done? Then Saul hurled his spear at him to strike him down. So Jonathan knew that his father had decided to put David to death. Then Jonathan arose from the table in fierce anger and did not eat food on the second day of the new moon, for he was grieved over David because his father had dishonored him. Jonathan was loyal to his buddy. He had David's back. He was willing not only to make a promise of help, but to keep that promise, even though it might cost him anything. What were the three things that Jonathan was willing to sacrifice for his buddy? First thing we notice is he was willing to sacrifice his dad's approval, the king's approval. Saul, with contempt, spoke of Jonathan and trying to shame him, calling him the son of a perverse and rebellious woman. Jonathan would not be turned because his father was putting him to shame. He did not care about his father's approval in that moment. Saul pressed on. When that didn't work, he turned it up a little bit. Next thing he did was, it's like he dangled a carrot in front of Jonathan, his son's nose, and he said, "Remember the throne. As long as David is alive, you're not going to inherit my throne." He tried to get him to sell out his buddy for that throne. Jonathan wouldn't be deterred. He stayed true to his buddy. And when Saul realized that those strategies to get Jonathan to turn weren't going to work, he took a spear and hurled it at Jonathan, his own son, to try to pin him and kill him. Jonathan was willing to sacrifice his own life in order to defend his friend David. You show me people who are willing to sacrifice like that to offer help to someone, keep their word, and then be willing to sacrifice those kinds of things, and I'll show you dangerous friendships. These two men, Jonathan and David at this point, realize they have to say goodbye. David cannot stay. If he does, he's going to be a dead man. So they know they have to separate. They believe it might be for the very last time that they're going to see each other. So they come together to say farewell. And look what happens in verse 41 when they get ready to say goodbye. So chapter 20, verse 41. When the lad was gone, David rose from the south side and fell on his face to the ground and bowed three times. And they kissed each other and wept together, but David more. And Jonathan said to David, "Go in safety. Inasmuch as we have sworn to each other in the name of the Lord, saying, 'The Lord will be between me and you and between my descendants and your descendants forever.' Then he arose and departed while Jonathan went into the city." So their covenant relationship is reconfirmed. And we know later we realize how much that covenant meant, even to future generations. But at this point, they say goodbye, they say farewell. And it was a very, very emotionally affectionate farewell. Imagine if when we came back in for lunch, you would have seen Paul, me, Jim. We would have been over here on our faces, on our knees, hugging, sobbing, kissing each other. You guys would have, I bet that would have gotten your attention. And you would have looked and said, "What is happening with these pillars? This is not what we expected." I don't know, maybe some of us, depending on our, you know, maybe if you didn't know us very well, you might have even been tempted to snicker a little bit. "Look at these guys. What's wrong with these guys? Act like men." I promise you, Jonathan and David were not the kind of guys you would have wanted to snicker in their face. I mean, if you did that, they had the ability probably to dart their hand out, stick it into your throat, grab your esophagus out, and slap you a few times before you drop to the ground. These guys were hardened warriors. These guys weren't soft sissies. They were strong. They were warriors, but they were also incredibly affectionate, willing to express something they were feeling on the inside. What were they feeling? Why this emotional outburst of these two warriors? Go back to 1 Samuel 18, 1 through 4, when their relationship was initiated. Do you remember? It said that their souls were knit together. So if you give me two souls that are knit together, and now these two souls are having to say goodbye, ugh, that's going to be painful. What will that feel like as they're coming apart and going in different directions? It's not going to be easy. It's going to be painful. Jonathan and David were hurting deeply. They were feeling it deeply, and they were willing to express it openly to each other. You show me when that kind of affection and communication, sharing of emotion honestly because two people's souls have been knit together and they're having to say goodbye, that is the makings of a dangerous friendship. I think it's that kind of thing that sometimes serves as glue between people, not just women, but between men as well. So they thought that might be for the last time. Actually, there was a subsequent to this, there was one more encounter that's recorded here in 1 Samuel 23, 15 through 18. We're not going to take time to talk about that. But basically, those two men come together again. Jonathan knows David is at his end. He's going from cave to cave, just trying to hide and stay alive. Perhaps he is downcast. Perhaps he's about ready to quit. Jonathan, his friend, knows that and goes out to find him. And he goes to him, and it says that he strengthened him, or he encouraged him in the Lord. So I picture David's head down, his posture defeated, broken. His buddy Jonathan shows up and takes his chin and lifts his vision upward to God to remind him about who his God is, what his God is like, the plan that his God has for him. And evidently, it was enough. Jonathan experienced enough of an infusion of new courage from his friend that he kept going on. So let me ask you this. We went through some of these traits of their dangerous friendship kind of quickly. And so a question, rhetorical, all my questions here are rhetorical. But how do these traits of dangerous friendship fall on you? As you hear about Jonathan and David's friendship, you look at these characteristics, these traits, as you think about your own friendships in your life, how do these fall on you? What do they leave you feeling like? When I completed my study, second time through 1 Samuel, this is how I felt. I looked at these traits, and I began to feel very, very discouraged. Because when I looked around in my life, I saw that I had some friendships. I had a wife that I knew if I had to say goodbye to her, it would make me cry. But there were no other friendships. Maybe my mom and dad, Karen, I would cry if I had to say farewell to them. But I didn't have any friends that I could think of that if I had to say goodbye, it would cause me to cry. And that troubled me because I felt like I don't have dangerous friendships. I see that this is something I should have, that I need. I was convinced I needed it finally. And what I did was, is I used that kind of disappointment, that sadness, that sense of lacking to drive me to pray. And I began to pray earnestly. I mean, not just once. I kept praying day after day saying, God, please give me dangerous friendships in my life like I've seen between Jonathan and David. I want to have some friends like that. So I prayed. I made that a focus. Second thing I did was I started to take inventory of the friendships I did have in my life. And I realized I did have some friendships. They just weren't at the point where I would say they were dangerous yet. And so there were several guys that I went to, and I had what the world calls defining the relationship talks with, DTR talks. Usually that's thought of between a man and a woman. I had that with other men where I basically talked about what I'd been learning about dangerous friendship. And I said, I feel like you and I have the potential to have that kind of a friendship. And I'd like to trust God for that. And it felt a little risky doing that because I didn't know how those guys were going to respond. But to a man, each of the guys I talked to responded by saying, that's good. And I would like that too. And I began to watch and began to look at those relationships and trust God to develop them. The third thing I did was I realized I needed a teacher to help me practically develop friendships because I just wasn't very good at it. I was good at tasks. I wasn't good at cultivating relationships. And at that point in my life, the best teacher I knew who I felt like knew how to do relationships really well was my wife, Karen. I had watched her develop all these amazing friendships wherever she went. And it didn't even really take that long, it didn't seem. And I started to watch the things that she did. Things like, you know, meeting friends for coffee and talking. Things like writing cards to friends, expressing affection for them. Well, you're going to be relieved. I didn't look at Karen and then start inviting all my buddies out to sip lattes and talk over coffee. I didn't get a little flowery stick it notes and write messages of, you know, thinking of you today. Nothing like that. What I did was, though, I saw some of the things that were in Karen and her priority of friends and how she spent time with them, how she communicated with them, how she expressed fondness for them and need for them. And I said, that's what I need to start doing. I do need to do it in a different way, though. So usually it was while we were trying to catch steelhead or salmon in the Snake River. Or, you know, we were sitting down over a big, sloppy, unhealthy pizza. And then I thought, yeah, I'm not going to write little flowery cards, but I do want to start putting into words how I feel about some of these men that are in my life that could be dangerous friends. And that was incredibly helpful. The last thing I did was I realized I needed to make an investment of time, money, energy to see those relationships develop. And that just was not a natural, easy thing for me to do. I was always occupied with tasks. Sometimes it felt like those kinds of relational things were just like extra that I never had time for or that I never had money for. And I'm so thankful that I was married to a woman who knew I needed a network of strong male friendships, dangerous friendships in my life. And that's how Karen was. She was never threatened by those friendships. She never tried to, you know, keep her hands on me and say, Todd, I want you to be my all in all. You're like my girlfriend. You know, anytime Karen would try to look to me as a girlfriend, she was going to be really disappointed. I didn't listen to her like her girlfriends. I didn't understand like her girlfriends. You know, I realized very early on, she was different than my friends who were men. If I treated her like I treated my friends who were men, that didn't really go too far. It didn't really register with her in a way that she embraced that. She wanted me to have my friends who were men. And I think the reason why is because she knew what those men were like. She knew that they were men who knew God very well. Not just about God, they knew God, they were passionate for God's glory, and they took steps of action to honor God and serve his people. Those were the kind of men that were around me, and Karen knew that it was men like that that could be a safety net for us. So that if ever in our marriage I started to act like an idiot and do stupid, foolish things and start to wander off bad paths, Karen knew there was a safety net group of men around me that knew what was going on in my life and would be strong enough to do whatever it would take to get me back on track. And so I am thankful that you always gave me a blessing to cultivate those kind of relationships. Like I said, though, I didn't really feel like there was ever anyone in my life that would, a friend that would make me cry if I had to say goodbye. I got to Sac State, and Tim was the director. Karen was what was called back then the associate campus director. I came on that team as what's called the senior man back then. And so we worked together for 3 years in ministry. At the end of that 3 years, Tim believed that he was called to come up to Boise to continue ministry up here. So he and Renee and their young family were going to come up to Boise. So we knew our time in Sacramento was over. And I was going to take over as the new director in Tim's place. And we were out in the late summer for what we knew was going to be the last time. And we had gone out to eat. We came back to an apartment. We were sitting around on the floor. And we were reminiscing about our 3 years together at Sac State. And as we were doing that, we were kind of laughing. It was pretty fun. We had a lot of memories going on in our minds. Their little daughter, Savannah, I can't remember how old she was at the time. How old was Savannah when you guys moved up to Boise? Do you remember? Just approximately? So 7 or 8. And so we're all sitting on the floor reminiscing, and seriously, something really frightening happened to me physiologically. In that moment, I felt something in my stomach. It started to get tight down there. It got tighter, tighter. It turned into like this horrible knot. And that knot started to climb up. It got all the way here and it stopped. And I didn't know what was happening. And then all of a sudden, something damp, I felt something damp in my eyes. And I thought, oh my goodness, I think I'm about ready to cry. And I didn't cry. I just didn't cry. And so I was shocked by what was going on with me. And immediately my reflex was to say, I've got to stop this. I can't do this. And so I started to try to think of other things to distract myself from what we were all talking about, all these fond memories. And then I thought of Jonathan and David and their farewell. And I said, wait a minute. This is a good thing. This is what I've been praying for. And so I just let my mind rush into all those memories. And the tears just started to come out. Tim looked up at me, and I would say, I think this is fair. You're probably a little more emotionally expressive than me. And Tim saw these tears in my eyes, and all of a sudden, there come some tears in Tim's eyes. And I saw those in him, he saw those in me, and the next thing I knew, my shoulders started to shake. And there were a few. I started bawling. Tim was bawling. And when we started making sounds, that got Karen and Renee's attention. They looked at us like, what is happening here? And of course, that's all it took for them to start bawling. So pretty soon you had the four adults, really the pillars around little Savannah, bawling like babies. And Savannah had been she wasn't in tune with what was going on. She looked around her and all these adults in her life were now sobbing and bawling. And so she got very nervous. She started to try to say corny things and try to get us to stop crying, to get our composure. But we couldn't. We just kept crying and sobbing. Finally, we gathered our composure. Then it came time for us to leave. And Karen and I were the ones driving away. We went out to the parking lot. And as we were out there heading toward the car, then it really registered with Savannah, I think, what was going on. And then she started bawling. And as Karen and I drove away that night, though, I felt like I had just played a football game. I was exhausted. My body ached because I just wasn't used to doing that. But it felt so good. There was something that felt so good about that. And I realized God had answered my prayer. And I had at least one man in my life that I would then characterize as that was a dangerous friendship. What's pretty awesome about that is God not only answered that prayer with one new dangerous friendship. The next few years, there were about two or three other times where I ended up bawling, having to say goodbye to friends. And one of those was with the Rusts. They came and they joined our team in Sacramento, and we got to work together for a year. And after 3 years, then Karen and I felt like God was calling us to move up to Pullman, Washington, to work at Washington State. So we were going to leave. I wanted to hand the baton off to a solid couple, Paul and Elaine, and so he was going to become the new director at Sac State. And we went out to the car for Karen and I to leave, and you know, you had Paul and Elaine and Sam, and we just had Tyler at that time, who's very, very young, and we started talking, saying goodbye. Same thing happened. I ended up bawling. Paul and Elaine were bawling. Karen was bawling because we were saying goodbye, and it hurt so deeply. But again, it felt so good. It's pretty amazing. There's I'd say I have probably four or five friendships that I'd characterize and say those are gifts from God. Those are dangerous friendships. And Paul and Tim are two of those four or five. And what's amazing is each of those four or five men in my life who's a dangerous friend, their personalities are all very different. Different from me and different from each other. What a gift that has been to me in my life. You know, when you find friendships like that, like we look at here, that you will become more dangerous for the kingdom of light against the domain of darkness. In closing, I just want to do one other thing. This is a little different. I want us to pause for a moment, be still before God. And perhaps you know of people in your life that you would say, that is a dangerous friendship that you're really thankful for. And I, in order to thank, praise, and honor God, I just want you to share out loud the name of that dangerous friend. And there's no order to it. We're just going to pause, be quiet, and if a name comes to mind, just go ahead and shout that name out. The other thing you can do is perhaps there's someone who you'd say, I don't know if I have a dangerous friendship with this person yet, but there's potential for this. Shout that name out as well. So in the next minute, I just want us to lift up to God these people who maybe he's already given to us as a dangerous friend, or there's great potential for that if we trust him for it. Does that make sense what I'm asking us to do in the next minute? So there's a chance we might do this, and this might be a minute of silence. Or maybe we're going to hear a lot of names popping off like popcorn. And that's what I'm praying. Don't worry that you're going to say a name while someone else says a name at the same time. That's okay. I expect that to happen. God will hear these expressions of thanksgiving and praise to him. Let's be still and lift up these names. Tim. Paul. Derek. Jerry. Father, we thank you for these people who you've just brought to our mind. We know that we're not supposed to look to appearance, relationships, performance, possessions as a basis for our identity. But we know we can look to these things as amazing gifts from you, including all these friendships we just mentioned. Thanks for providing these for each one of us. I ask that you'd be protecting these relationships, fostering, cultivating these friendships for us, that these friendships would become increasingly dangerous, make us increasingly dangerous for your kingdom of light against the domain of darkness. We pray these things in Christ's name. Amen.